BOAG World is brought to you by headscape.co.uk. This week on BOAG World, Stephen Anderson on emotional design. I review the iPad and we talk fonts, flash and photos. Podcast for all those involved in designing, developing, and running websites on a daily basis. Welcome to episode 213 of BOAGworld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul BOAG.
And my name is Marcus Lillington.
And here we are yet again.
I know, it feels like ages ago since the last one, because we recorded the last one kind of like a week early.
Yes.
This one's like as late as it possibly can.
Yes.
So it feels like we've missed one out. But
it's
we
good.
Haven't.
And even better news.
What?
We haven't got to do one next week.
Is that because it's a bank holiday in the UK?
Yes, so I think that makes everybody happy, both us and the listener that has to endure this every week. Notice listener singular. I think that's where we've reached now.
No, we haven't.
Well, you know, what can I say? Yeah, so we're not having a show next week because we've got a bank holiday in the UK and I'm screwed, you know.
You're just screwed. Paul went to a conference last week and he was moaning that he actually had to do some work.
I had to do so much.
And now
normally
he can't
I
talk.
Do,
this is a week ago.
Normally I do one half hour talk. I had to do a whole day workshop.
Uh-huh.
My half an hour talk.
Without me.
Without you, because you didn't turn up. My half an hour talk. I had to do a design clinic that took about 2 hours. And then, on top of that, I had to make up a talk on the spot, on the stage, because somebody had to drop out.
Oh, that's right. You did a talk on business, and I asked Keir Whittaker if you were covering accountancy and business law.
No, I wasn't. So I think now I should have at least a month off.
Absolutely.
And it's so sunny and nice here. Why would anyone want to do work?
Yeah, it's supposed to be stopping today, though.
We
always have to talk about the weather, don't we?
Well, I've decided
it's been really
something.
Mediterranean,
right? You know that everywhere closes down when it snows, mm-hmm. Right? Like the schools close down, and you know everybody kind of understands if you can't get into work.
Yeah.
Why can't we make up a new rule that says everybody understands if it's a really nice sunny day, everyone's going to close down?
Well, Headscape, you've probably forgotten this, has a kind of internal rule that if working conditions are over 35 degrees, then we don't work.
Since when?
That's years ago, but 2006, the hottest summer on history.
And we stopped, did
yeah.
we?
No, I don't think we actually did. We said we probably should.
Right.
Because it was just ridiculous.
Well, that's not good enough.
So, it's a nice day. It doesn't come under that.
It's
a
nice day.
If it's really, 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 really hot.
There are certain... And there must be laws about this kind of thing.
Yeah. I think there are. Otherwise, Chris wouldn't agree to that, would he?
No. But I want a law that says, oh, if it's just really nice outside, just that's fine. Just sneak off. So, here we go. All web designers. You guys, you spend too much of your life sitting indoors...
Yeah.
You're all sickly and pale. So here I am as the daddy of web design, as someone described me as recently.
No, it wasn't.
No, that was Zeldman's, the granddad.
Yeah.
I'm the grumpy old dad. Somebody, I can't remember anyway.
Yeah.
So
I'm the cool uncle.
I'm giving you permission. It should be the cool uncle that gives permission to slope off today if it's nice where you are.
Yeah.
So there we go. Except this probably isn't coming out to Friday, by which point
it'll be
raining.
It'll
be
cold and horrible, yeah.
Yeah, because it's bank holiday weekend, of course it is. And also, I'm taking Thursday...
I'm going to check the weather. You carry on.
I'm taking Wednesday, Thursday and Friday off. Hey, you know last...
Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. And Monday, because it's a bank holiday.
Absolutely.
You bloody skiver. And you're moaning about today, but I'm a bit tired and...
Yeah, well... I'm only taking tomorrow off to do boring things anyway. Anyway, that's the other thing I wanted to say.
19 and sunny on Saturday.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Which is not as warm as it was last
week.
Are we
really overdoing this? Should we just rename this the Weather Show? The Weather Show with Paul and Marcus.
People wouldn't expect anything other than two Englishmen.
talking about the weather.
Yeah.
We like to be stereotypical.
Absolutely.
Look, if you are laughing at us out there because you live in some country.
Oh, they always say, yeah, I'm in Australia and it's currently 35 today, tomorrow, yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. The reason we talk about the weather is because we live in such a ridiculous place with such a changeable climate. That's all. If you live somewhere like that, you'd be the same.
Yeah, our weather is interesting like us.
Yes. Changeable, temperamental, and often moody.
Yeah. Is there anything more interesting than the weather?
Well, I was going to talk about the fact that, remember last week I was ranting about Facebook?
Yeah.
And I said that...
And now you love it because it works.
No, yeah? I don't love it because it works, but we do have a Facebook fan page. I was going to say Boag World. At facebook.com/BoagWorld. So please join up and invite your friends to do so. We're going to try and do a bit of exclusive content there from time to time when I remember.
Ooh.
So that'd be cool.
Okay.
So, I'm pleased with that. Yeah, go on, what are you going to say?
I don't know, I haven't got anything to say.
It's part of this new Facebook's taking over the world and abusing all our privacy, so I figure why not jump on board and embrace our new
overlords. I must go and actually look at the page. That would be a start, wouldn't it?
That would be a start.
I could do that now.
I've got a little button now at the bottom of all my articles that say like, and you can click on it and you like things. It's like retweeting.
Right. Does it actually retweet, or do you just
like it? No, it goes up onto Facebook, and everybody on Facebook knows how much you like Paul's work.
Okay. I'm so old. Yeah, that sounds great.
Well, you don't even tweet as much anymore, do you?
No.
You're losing your drive and passion, Marcus. I'm worried about you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why. Maybe we should have a whole show about why I'm not tweeting as much.
Perhaps we ought to have a show about...
I haven't got anything interesting
about losing your passion.
Yeah, all right.
Well, actually, I think that's actually a fairly reasonable topic for a show. Because we work in this very high... We could do a show on stress, losing your passion, you know, and that whole thing of not being able to keep up because we live in a fast-moving, you know, industry.
Mm.
I think it's actually a real problem. I mean, that's what I've been talking about recently with this whole mentoring thing that I've been going on about. Have you seen this?
No.
So it's a big thing that I talked a lot about in future web design. I was talking about it before we came away as well, which is this idea that so many freelancers, you know, are working by themselves.
Yep, you did. Yeah, I do remember.
And
that's
why I'm really grateful for the setup we've got at Headscape, where you, me and Chris can bounce ideas off of one another. And and in addition to that, we've got Brian as well, who comes and shakes us up every now and again. And I don't think most people have that. So I think there's a need for a web design counsellor to tell you you're special.
But then I, as I mentioned to you earlier, I did actually read one of, well, it was not one of your articles, something you pointed out on your posterous site, which is about the title of which is "What is the point of being productive?"
And I can't even remember what that article was about.
Yeah, it's all basically about be yourself and don't try and, you know, reach other people's goals and all that.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
So that's why I do nothing for a living.
If we all live like that, nothing would ever get done.
But don't you think? I do think that we live in a culture that is overly driven.
God, yeah.
You know, if you take like Italy or the south of France, so that's the kind of pace I think we should be running life at.
Well, I saw a wonderful photograph on somebody's, actually it was on their Facebook page instead of their picture of them, which was, it was just a slogan saying the best things in life aren't things.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's how we are.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean you need to accept it blindly.
No, but it is the way we are. And, you know, I've got kids, who are big kids, who have been through the schooling system, and it's all about ticking boxes and getting the right grades so that you can go on to the next set of boxes to tick and get the right grades. And
what's the point of it all? When there's a lovely sunny day outside, we're back to the weather again.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's tricky. But then if everything in the media is saying you need this, you know, all of this thing, that thing, these things, those things, and you aspire to quite a lot because you actually quite like a lot of these things. But if you live the life that the more sort of relaxed, more sedentary pace, which we all aspire to, you can't have those things.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of okay with that.
Well, yeah, I think most of us say we're okay with that, but we're actually not when it comes to something when we really do want it, like an iPad, for example.
No, but if I couldn't have had that, I would prefer... Time to me is my most valuable asset. We've talked about this before.
Mm.
You know, where you want stack loads of cash, I want more time.
I don't really. I want stack loads of cash and loads of time. Because I'm honest.
Yeah, no. But if I had to pick one or the other, which you do have to, I would pick time every time.
Yeah, but you, yeah, I, you, It's hard. That,
this is getting into one of those conversations you have when you're stoned at 3 a.m.
Man. Well, that's the
not
thing.
Like, no.
Oh, no, no. Well, drinking alcohol, of course. Yes. But that's another thing. Yeah, you want to buy that bottle of wine. You can't. Or you can't get in the pub.
Yeah, but there's a balance to it. And I think our balance... You know, people in Italy, in the south of France, can afford wine. In fact, they live off of wine.
Yeah,
you know,
it's cheaper out there, generally speaking. Yeah, but, I know, and it's how you're taxed and all of that kind of thing. And it's a more socialist way of looking at things.
And we're just such a... I think we're just such an unnecessarily driven culture. The only thing that makes me work as hard as I do is guilt. Guilt about letting other people down. Other than that...
And mine's approval.
Well, yeah.
Same thing, really.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Just the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why? Why can't we give ourselves permission
to relax about being a show-off as well. There's a little bit of that in there, sort of like, you know, I've done a good job. Look at my good job.
Oh, no, I've got no pride in my work. Have you seen the stuff I produce?
You liar.
No, I do, but, you know, I don't know. There is a line somewhere, and I'm a great believer that us as a culture are far too hardworking, and we can push that line back a long way before we start getting lazy.
I agree, in principle, but if you try to do that, then people will jump over the top of you, and they will carry on with this hardworking culture.
So what?
And they'll be running the show, as it were, and the expectations of our kids will be those people.
Yeah, but you don't always have to be the best. You know, I would prefer, for example, with Headscape, yes, you're right. If we all slacked off, okay, and we did less work, we would piddle along as a, you know, as a small company. You know, we won't be the best in our industry. So what?
Yeah,
if we're happy,
with that.
I'd prefer to be happy than the best, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree with that. But it's so hard to find.
So come work with Headscape. We're second best.
Well, second best is all right.
Well, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. There is a balance, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's where that balance.
Cool.
Sits,
you seriously could do a whole show on this.
Yeah,
it's interesting stuff. But really, not what people have tuned in to hear about. Well, it's not often we have a little conversation like this.
No, we don't talk to each other usually.
No.
Off air, that's it.
No.
Shun different limousines
rooms.
And everything.
Different limousines. Okay, should we move on to the news? Okay, so really kind of my first news story, but isn't normally a kind of thing I talk about in the news, is I wanted to talk about the future of web design, which I've just attended, and I don't normally talk about that as part of the news, but I did want to share a little bit about this year's future of web design, because I think it's relevant and useful to you guys.
I was too busy to go.
You were, apparently.
I was.
That's. Do you know why?
Everyone else.
Do you know why you were too busy? Because you lived too much of a hectic lifestyle, and you're living up to other people's expectations of you the whole time, Marcus. Just relax, man. How have I ended up being the hippie? So wrong.
It is wrong, yeah.
Right. Cartonified conferences are normally good, but this year was exceptional. The speakers were brilliant, the venue was stunning, and they even fed us lunch, Marcus. You missed out on a really nice lunch.
And they
lunch
gave you chocolates.
For 2 days. That was only special people.
Special people?
Yeah, the people with special needs.
Well, I have a special chocolate need, definitely. As you probably know.
Anyway, none of that's why I want to talk about it. The reason I want to talk about it is because we were told about four websites that I kind of picked up on that I wanted to mention because they'll probably be of interest to people listening to this. The first one is Think Vitamin Membership. So announced at Future of Web Design was this idea of Think Vitamin Membership, and it's going to launch next month. And basically, it's a direct competitor to Lynda.com. So I don't know whether you know about that. But essentially, for less than a dollar a day.
I read all about it.
Did
yeah.
you? You get membership, which gives you access to a growing library of web tutorials, 4 online conferences a year, live question and answer sessions with leading figures in the web community, and discounted tickets to Cartonified events. So basically, they're churning out loads of tutorials about different subjects. Mm-hmm. And it looks really good, I have to say. I think it's a really good deal.
Does it say what the discount on the FOD and FOA are? I can't remember.
No. I don't think it's that big a discount. I think it's kind of equivalent to the early bird discount, but you kind of get guaranteed you'll get that rate, or I'm not quite sure, right, to be honest. But it, I mean, the online conferences, the fact that they're throwing in four online conferences, and online conferences I think are great, with the addition of the tutorial stuff that they're doing and the questions and answers, which are with people like Kevin Rose and Gary Vaynerchuk and stuff like that. So I've got to say, I think it's a pretty good deal. So I think that's worth checking out. There's a link
in the show notes. Priced.
I think it's certainly very makes you well think, priced.
Is that worth it? Well, yeah, actually, that's quite good. Yeah, but you know, it isn't snap their arm off. But no.
Well, I mean, on the first day of the conference, I had 1,000 people sign up for it.
Mm.
So that's got to be a good sign. I think it's going to be around. It's going to be a good one. So check it out. Link in the show notes, boeggworld.com/podcast/213. The next little link that was mentioned, one of the speakers at FOA was a guy called Robin Christofferson, who we've had on the show before, talking about accessibility. And one of the problems he was talking about was capture, and the little images that you have to fill in to say that you're human.
Well, I mean, I have a real problem. Well, everyone has a problem reading them with sight.
Exactly.
I know that's the point, but...
So he kind of talked about how even the audio ones that they put with them are really problematic to him, you know, right, and he can hear perfectly well. So what he mentioned was something called text capture, which is, you'll have already seen this around. It's the fact where you have to do very basic logic problems like 2 + 2 or whatever, that kind of thing. Well, there's basically a website where there's an API you can plug into that's got access to kind of thousands of these that you can just plug straight into your site and use. So I thought that was a really good thing. You know, it was a good one because, I mean, obviously the problem with text captures and the idea of logic problems is if you've got a cognitive disability, you might struggle to do them. Mm. But if there are thousands of them available and you can just say, give me another one, give me another one, give me another one, then eventually there'll be one that you can do. So check that out. That was text capture. The next thing that came out of Future of Web Design was a tool that Remy Sharp mentioned, and it's called FireQuery. And it's an add-on to Firebug, which has got great features if you're somebody that works with jQuery, which I think increasingly most of us are. So check that one out as well, just for debugging jQuery stuff and working with jQuery. So check that one out. The final link I wanted to mention that came up from the show was a CSS generator, which was recommended by Dan Cederholm, and it is invaluable if you're starting to use some of the more advanced CSS properties, either, you know, things like basically box shadow, text shadow, gradients, all that kind of stuff. And essentially it's providing a GUI interface that generates the code for CSS gradients, shadows and transforms, which are a bit of a convoluted piece of code. So if there's a tool that can do it for you, all the better. Also gives you a live preview of what you're going to get, which is really useful as well. I've already used it on a project that I'm working on since I've got back, and I have to say it was very much a time saver. So there are a few good things that came out of Future Web Design. I mean, obviously that's not any of the good talks and stuff, but some useful links.
Next, it did sound up, good. I did think, oh, that all sounds like fun.
Yeah, it was a really good one. You did miss out this time, I'm afraid.
Never mind.
Sorry. The big news story of the week is the fact that Google have teamed up with Typekit to launch the Google Font API. Have you seen this?
No. I knew it was out, but right, I hadn't actually gone and had a look.
So the arrival of Google...
I preferred the Google logo on Friday afternoon.
What, the Pac-Man logo? That was superb, wasn't it?
Have a play!
They're keeping it permanently alive, by the way. So anytime you can go to google.com/Pac-Man and you can get
it. It's always going to be there.
It's always there for you, Marcus.
Wonderful.
So, I mean, yeah, basically this is Google storming into the crowded marketplace of web typography with the likes of Typekit, FontDeck and Fonts.com. So it's another good boost to web fonts. What makes Google's approach unique is that they are focusing on open source fonts. So this means that the service is entirely free and doesn't rely on JavaScript. You basically just link to the font that you want and away you go. It couldn't be easier. And actually, in the show notes, you can see me showing how simple it is. So check that out. Although there's a font, the font directory that they've got only consists of 18 fonts at the moment, I'm sure it's going to grow very quickly. And with Google's reputation for speed and robustness, some of the concerns that I've had about relying on a third-party service are reduced slightly. Mm-hmm. Web fonts are still far from perfect with issues over download size and anti-aliasing. However, the more companies we see entering this space, the faster we'll see the services mature. So it's good to see Google adding their weight to web typography. All good stuff. Next story up is about choosing imagery, and choosing the right image for your website is a really quite problematic a lot of the time. In fact, I'm suffering with this right now, as Marcus will have heard me swearing and ranting this morning.
What are you swearing and ranting about today, Paul?
Yes, my chosen subject today is imagery. It's even harder for website owners who don't have any training in design to pick the right image, and the designers and website owners coming together to decide on imagery, you know, is difficult. Except that it's a really important thing, because your choice of imagery can have a significant effect on how users perceive your site. And also, it's something that we have to do not just once when we create the original templates, but time and time again for kind of elements that, you know, drop in and sit alongside our content. Fortunately, the Web Designer Depot has a helpful post called Avoiding Perfect Photo Syndrome. And the aim of the post is to help you overcome the problem of finding the perfect image. Because according to the post, there are two essential problems: a lack of ideas and a glut of art. So first, it helps you overcome a lack of ideas by focusing you on what you want to communicate. What is it you want to communicate? How do you want to communicate that? It then refines this through experimentation and word association and that kind of stuff. And finally, it encourages us to be original by doing something unexpected and thinking beyond the first impressions that we might instinctively have. Then they deal with the idea of this glut of imagery that's available. You know, when you go to, you know, what, there are hundreds of photo libraries out there, all of which have got thousands, if not millions, of images on. So this article helps to narrow the field by looking at shape, color, tone, and focus. For website owners, I think this post is a great introduction to the design principles behind image selection. But for web designers, it's more of an encouragement to experiment and try new stuff rather than endlessly searching for the perfect image. The post ends with some wise words. It says, choosing images doesn't always have to be hard work. Trouble usually comes when you try and hunt down the one perfect image. Lacking images is akin to having writer's block. Sometimes the cure is to stop worrying and start experimenting.
Mm.
And to be honest, that's exactly what needs to happen on this project that I'm currently working on, is that the client is getting very kind of uptight about a particular image, where really you just need to put it up there and see how people react and then replace it.
Mm.
But there you go.
Well, one of the things we often suggest as part of a design, setting a new design, is that images for that new design fit a particular type of theme.
Yeah.
Like close-ups, for example. Yeah. Well, close-ups is a good example, because if you have that, you can only use close-up images on your website. It immediately focuses your image search.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, it's certainly worth considering from that point of view. And I've actually never thought about putting that point across when I'm talking to people about taking that approach. It will help you in the future select your new images.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Okay.
Right. I think my final news story is to mention a great post by Jonathan Snook about the changing role of Flash. Now, I've talked a lot about Flash on the show before. This view from Jonathan, I think, brings a very mature and sensible perspective to it. Look, I'd say up front, you know, this is really just aimed at the web design community. So if you're a website owner, you can probably skip this one. However, if you are a web designer or developer, I would recommend that you read it. It's possibly the most balanced, down-to-earth and pragmatic assessment of Flash I've ever read. And it begins with a history lesson, really, explaining why Flash was needed in the first place. And Jonathan explains that Flash exists to fill the gaps in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. So he says, between now and then, they've managed to... They've managed to offer useful features such as cross-domain requests, local storage, binary sockets, multiple file uploads, and shared objects. On the animation front, there's 3D effects, inverse kinetics, and pixel blending, bending. On the streaming side, there's support for multiple codecs, full screen playback, and dynamic streaming. Flash also allows for screen, audio, and webcam capture, as well as peer-to-peer connections. So he's talking about what the way that Flash is filling the gap. Flash fills in the gaps in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Mm-hmm. Then he points out that developments in W3C technologies and improved browser support started to make some of these jobs redundant. However, as he points out, HTML5 just doesn't have the same breadth of features as Flash. And that's not to say browsers won't get there some days, it's just not there yet. The thrust of his argument is really summed up in the last two paragraphs. As web developers, we should choose the best tool and technology for the job. To do otherwise, out of ignorance or some duty to web standards, is a disservice to the client and customers we serve. Right now, HTML5 is slowly becoming a viable alternative to Flash for a great variety of situations. However, Flash will continue to fill the gap for years to come because it continues to solve problems that web developers have that can't be solved by any other client-side technology. And it's hard to argue with that. You know, however much I personally dislike Flash, I think Jonathan makes some brilliant points. I think it's a bit of a wake-up call, this article. But I have to say, I'm glad that I'm having to turn to Flash less and less to solve problems. So there you go. That's the news for today. Let's move on to our interview. Okay, our interview is brought to you by Get Sign-Off, which is our own, very own hassle-free way to get design sign-off from your clients. Check it out. There's a really good blog associated with it now that's got lots of information about client management advice. We've introduced lower prices, and there is a free account so you can try it out yourself. There's also a really good post that Ryan's put up this week where he shows the wireframe of where Get Sign Off is going to go and what we're intending to do with it in the future, which is really exciting stuff. Mm. Okay, our interview today is with Stephen Anderson. And I saw him at South by Southwest this year, and he talks about emotional design, which it came across as the primary theme at this year's Future Web Design Conference as well. It's the thing to pay attention to. So I have to say, this is probably one of the most useful interviews you'll hear on Boeing World for some time. So here you go. Here's Stephen Anderson. Okay, so joining me today is Stephen Anderson. Good to have you on the show, Stephen.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I heard you at South by Southwest this year and thought, I have to get this guy on the show. You gave a brilliant talk about kind of, how would you describe it? What would you say that it was about?
Well, the phrase I've started using is the title of the talk, and it's actually caught on as seductive interactions. Mm-hmm. And it's actually caught on conversations where people have started saying, oh, yeah, he's the guy who talks about seductive interactions, as if it's a different type of a thing. It was really just the title of the talk, but it's kind of ended up becoming a phrase that people are using. But basically what I'm interested in is what motivates people to take certain actions online. And so if you look up the definition of seduction, it's, you know, encouraging people to take a specific behavior. And there's a second half to that definition, which is it's frequently sexual in nature. But I just ignore that part and cross it off. But when I talk about seduction, it's things that that happen online and offline. It happen anywhere there's humans involved, where we just have a really good time. We really get, you know, seduced by whatever it is. And this can be a first date, which is the analogy I use in my presentation, or it could be, you know, going to Disney World or a good concert or, you know, any number of experiences. Mm.
So how did you get attracted to this? I mean, what's your kind of background and how did you end up looking at this as a subject?
Yeah. So my background, if you go back about 12 or 13 years, I started off, like most people, as a web and graphics designer. Mm-hmm. And of course there's that process of maturity where you start thinking more about, what you want people to do on the site. Can they can they find their way around the site? You know, so you start thinking about usability, information architecture, those things. And then you start thinking about product strategy and business goals and what we're trying to accomplish here from a business perspective. And so that eventually where it's this journey has led me is to a fascination with psychology and just what makes people make certain decisions or behave in certain ways. And in many ways, this is full circle for me because before I started off as a designer, I was actually a high school English teacher, teaching gifted and talented classrooms. And at that time, you know, I really got fascinated by some of the early brain science and some of the learning theories.
Yeah.
Particularly around, you know, what can help students remember things or retain knowledge? What can get their attention? And if you've got a classroom of ninth graders for 90 minutes, you, you know, you really need to figure out how to how to motivate them and how to keep them engaged. So I guess I had a trial by fire early on with young kids, but now I'm applying a lot of those same things to the web context.
So, I mean, this seems to be becoming a growing area in popularity. I'm seeing more and more written about the role of psychology in web design. How do you see it kind of fitting into the equation alongside things like usability, for example? Because it isn't a usability issue, is it? It's more of an engagement issue.
Yeah, an engagement issue or a motivation issue. In fact, I draw a pyramid. I call it kind of the user experience hierarchy of needs model. It's kind of riffing on like what Maslow did with our needs. And I talk about how there are basically six stages. You know, the first is you have this great idea, something that's functional and works. And the example I use to explain this is often the development of mobile phones. So you look back at the original Motorola phone. It's this big giant brick, but everyone's jumping up and down because, you know, you don't have to have lines. You can walk around freely.
Yeah.
And then over time, it moves up, and you got to work on the reliability. Let's make the network, the cell network, more reliable. Eventually, people start thinking about usability. Well, okay, it made sense for engineers, but let's make this work for most people. So you start thinking about form factor. You start thinking about usability, things like that. And so that's all the bottom half of the pyramid, the experience pyramid. And then the top half is the part that I'm really fascinated by. There's a shift from making things usable, which is often removing the problems, removing the barriers, to making it convenient. And the distinction I draw there is if something's convenient, it works a lot more like I think.
Yeah.
And a clear example of this would be Google Maps. Prior to that, you had MapQuest, and MapQuest was a perfectly usable product. But then Google Maps comes along, and you can drag it, you can resize, you have to click arrows, you can do all these things that are much more natural. And mm-hmm. so that's an example of moving from a perfectly usable map system to one that's more convenient. And then, of course, the highest levels are the one I really enjoy talking about, what makes something pleasurable.
Yeah.
And that's where we start to engage people on an emotional level, a seductive level. We make things fun. And the highest level, of course, isn't one you can cause or create, but it's when you can design the conditions for, and that's meaning, you know, actually mm-hmm. designing products that have meaning in people's lives. And so if you look and you know, go back to that mobile phone example, you know, we had the original Motorola brick that people are carrying around, and then you have some efforts at making things more usable. You have Sony Ericsson, you know, a design company and engineering company coming together to create a, you know, what's supposed to be a more usable, more friendly phone. But there's this point at which you have to shift from what's the task we're trying to do here to what's the experience we're trying to create.
Yeah.
And I would actually roll the clock back a little bit before the iPhone and look at the original Motorola Razr. And even though it didn't revolutionize the interactions, it was the first mobile phone that really where someone said, this is the industrial design I want. This is the vision. This is the form factor I want to create. Let's make the engineering conform to this form factor.
Yeah.
And so they were starting with the aesthetic experience of holding this phone and opening this phone. And it was an enormous success for Motorola. And then, of course, the iPhone comes along with redefining interactions and setting the bar for those. Of course, that's a very meaningful device for many people. It's a lot more than a phone. It's the mobile computing device that is we're all tied to. So anyway, that's kind of my frame or how I think about these things. And of course, when you talk about psychology and motivation, that's that upper half of the pyramid where you're making things fun, meaningful, engaging, playful, all these things that appeal to us on an emotional level.
Mm. So let's talk about that, you know, that idea of motivating users. You know, obviously most websites have some call to action, whatever that be. You know, what kind of techniques are you talking about here to motivate users?
Sure. So there's definitely a lot of things I talk about in the presentation are more of the persuasion bent. But there's also things just how can we leverage psychology to make the message easier to understand or easier to comprehend or understand why it's important to me. So I kind of try to cover all of those things. There's easy things that people do already, like testimonials. You know, a lot of sites have testimonials, and that's an example of social proof, where we see either these big brands or familiar names using it, or we see a lot of people endorsing something. And that just puts us at ease and lets us know, okay, I feel safer giving this entity, this site, my personal information. So that's an easy example. I'm fascinated by some of the more playful things where you create I wouldn't call it a game, but you create a game-like experience or create something that's very playful. And the example I use in the seductive interactions presentation is the music site iLike. Mm-hmm. And there's a little game I'll mention in a minute, but when you're signing up in the registration process, it's pretty routine until you get to the part where they want to know what kind of music you like. And if you've signed up for any number of music sites, there's a pretty familiar pattern or pretty familiar point you reach in the registration where you get the familiar empty form field and it says, you know, list your favorite bands or artists separated by comma. And so, you know, we have to recall from memory what are our favorite bands, who do we like, and, you know, we might list four or five bands and then continue on. iLike does something very different where instead of giving you the empty form field, they just splash up a screen of 35 randomly selective or apparently random bands, and they say, click on the ones you like. And first of all, that's a very surprising or unexpected interaction. So it's getting my attention because it wasn't what I expected. I'm seeing all these pictures of bands, most of whom I recognize, even if I don't care for the music, I recognize the artist. And I don't have to recall anything from memory. It's just very fun. My hand doesn't have to leave the mouse. I can and go to the keyboard instead. I can just click on things I like. Mm. And so I start doing that. And of course, you know, there's maybe three bands out of the 35 I click on the first page, and I get to the bottom and it asks, you know, do you want to see more? Or are you done with registering? And of course, I haven't clicked my favorite bands yet. So of course I want to see more. And in the story, I recount that I think I went through 10 pages of clicking more before they basically didn't give me the option to continue. But it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun just doing that, seeing what would they splash up next. And, you know, would the results, you know, on page 5 be better than the results on page 3? Like, would they see that I wasn't clicking, you know, any bands in a certain genre?
Yeah.
And, So it's not there's not a game per se to that, but it's very playful and game like in its engagement. That's an example I used. And the flip side of that, you know, I talk about having a fun time, and I think I clicked on 35 bands. The flip side of that, of course, is the business goals, where these music sites really want to know what your personal tastes are. They're, for them, the gold mine is your data.
Yeah.
What do you like? And so if you compare business results for a site like that versus many of these other music sites, I offered up 35 bands I like, whereas on other sites I might offer up 4 or 5. So they actually, it was a win-win where I had a great time and they got more data out of me.
Mm. I mean, this issue of kind of game-like playfulness, something that is coming up again and again recently. And a lot of people are looking to, you know, I don't know, computer or video games industry for inspiration. Do you feel that there's a difference between making a website game-like and making it kind of playful and fun?
Absolutely. In fact, I draw a distinction between game and game-like. And currently giving a similar talk called Serious Play, and it's really about how we can bring a lot of these ideas that I talk about to more traditional business applications, like a college enrollment form or filling out your taxes or, you know, these things that we traditionally consider kind of boring business apps.
Yeah, because when a lot of people think about their website, they don't think, they go, well, there's no way I can introduce game features into filling out a tax return.
Correct. But there are actually ways you can do that. But I think what a lot of people are doing is they're looking at the success of things like Foursquare and GoWalla,
yeah.
or, or the site Stack Overflow, which is a knowledge sharing site for programmers and developers. And they're saying, great, how can we make our sites more, you know, games like those? And they'll point to Foursquare and say, yeah, we want levels and we want badges and we want points and we want all these things. And so I think you're seeing right now a whole wave of sites, they're throwing in these very basic game mechanics, points, levels, scoreboards, achievements, and so on. And the comment I make is if you're building a game, even the best game in the world, one, games often have a limited duration. So you think about that new Xbox game that you get in the mail on a Friday afternoon and you basically hibernate over the weekend playing the game and you emerge Sunday night or Monday morning having completed it. There are obviously other games like Farmville where there's this idea of an appointment mechanic where they want to keep you coming back in short bursts over a sustained period of time. But even that, you know, you talk to Farmville fans that after 3 or 4 months, that can get a bit tiring. So that's just one reason I tend to shy away from making things a pure game. The other reason is I think it's kind of cheap and easy to drop in a lot of these game mechanics. And what I'm more fascinated by is why did these work in the first place? Why did I care that I got a badge from Foursquare for checking in 50 times? Why was this important to me? Or more to the point, you know, the whole idea of mayorship in Foursquare where I become the mayor of a place I check into frequently. And it's kind of a nice perk, you know, okay, I'm the mayor of this. I've checked in more than anyone else. But there's a point at which someone else checks in and ousts you as the mayor. And suddenly you have to drive back and eat at that restaurant or go to that bar to reclaim your mayorship. And so I'm fascinated by why these work in the first place. Yeah. And so rather than talk about things like levels or mayorship or points, I talk about things like appropriate challenges, you know, which are universally going back thousands of years. We love challenges. Variable rewards, the most blatant example of that being slot machines. Pattern recognition, curiosity, reputation, status, social proof. These are all the things that are timeless that motivate us. And so if we can start from that as our basis, I think we'll come up with creative things like mayorship rather than just copying those things. And mayorship is an example where if you go to psychology, there's this idea of loss aversion. You know, once we have ownership of something, we really don't want to lose it. It's also tied in with this idea of endowment effect where, you know, we may not value it before we had it, but now that we have it, we value it, you know, much more than we probably should. And so that's, you know, it may be mayorship on the surface, but they're tied into these deep psychology principles.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, are there people out there that you feel are doing this particularly well at the moment? Are there examples of sites that are really kind of using these psychological techniques?
Oh, yeah. I mentioned iLike.
And
there was a second half to the iLike story where they literally created a game, kind of a music playing game where you have to identify a song within a certain amount of time. One of the clever things there is they introduced this idea of status by way of your best streak. When we say status, a lot of times we think about how we're standing relative to other people. But status also means how you're standing relative to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the classic video games, you know, Pac-Man, Q-Bert, and things, it was really, can I beat my high score? And for the really good people, you know, there was a leaderboard, could you be on the top 10? But for most of us, it was, can I get better than I was before? Which is just tying back into status. But beyond iLike, I've recently started using MailChimp quite a bit. And I had an example or two in my presentation, but I hadn't really been a user until about a month ago. And I started using their service, and they've just got so many playful things built in across the site. One of these is at the top of the page, no matter where you're at, there's always their chimp or their monkey, kind of their mascot. And there are these random phrases that he'll say. And sometimes it's a phrase like, you know, I kissed a chimp and I like it. You know, just little funny things. You know, in a reference to pop culture music. Other times, you know, it'll be links to just really just funny, you know, non sequitur videos or funny non sequiturs like what was the one, who would win in a challenge between Chuck Norris and Iron Man. And it's a link and you click to it and there's a YouTube video where someone has the Iron Man action figure and a Chuck Norris action figure and they're finding it out. It's just this fun stuff. Not really tied directly to the task you're doing on the site. But what MailChimp has found is, you know, people are you know, using the site, doing these tasks that, you know, aren't necessarily the most enjoyable things in the world, but they're smiling, they're having a good time, they're in a good mood. While they're using this, and people have talked about, you know, hey, I was trying to do my newsletter and I looked up and saw the chimp, just smiled, and it made me feel better. And the interesting thing there is there's quite a bit of psychology around our emotions and how we are, when we're more relaxed or in a happy state of mind, where we can more likely find workarounds to troubling situations. Mm-hmm. And there's Don Norman talks about this in his book, Emotional Design, and talks about an ATM study where, you know, the more attractive ATM was perceived as easier to use. And the interesting thing is you can go back to studies in the 40s, and there's a very famous study where they asked people to, you know, pin. It was kind of a creative problem challenge where you had to figure out how to get a box of matches, like, stuck to the wall, or hold up a candle on the wall, basically. I'm getting fuzzy on the details, but basically what they found from that is people who are agitated and kind of a foul disposition were much less likely to find the solution compared to those who were in a more relaxed state of mind. And this, you know, we see this in other areas like brainstorming. Part of the reason it's good to get everyone relaxed and comfortable at the beginning of a brainstorming session is so that our brains are able to make those connections mm-hmm. we might not otherwise make. So, you know, all these ideas are really human principles that can apply in any place where there's a human involved, whether it's, you know, online, offline, you know, whatever the interaction may be.
I mean, some of these things feel almost a little bit counterintuitive when you've come from that kind of school of usability. I mean, for example, you talked at one stage about making things challenging, you know, and actually, you know, from a usability perspective, that's the last thing you want to do. You know, you want to make things easier. And then on the other hand, you talked about, you know, MailChimp and about how they put a video to, you know, put a link to a video outside of the workflow of what they're doing. You're actually distracting users from what they're supposed to be doing at any particular time. You know, so there's a bit of a balance here, I'm guessing.
Yeah, there's definitely a balance. You've got to evaluate everything in a, based on what the context is. But there are some things that are, as you say, counterintuitive. For example, putting in constraints is one I talk about, where you might introduce constraints on a review you can write on someone. And it might seem counterintuitive to do so, but that introduction of scarcity, in this case, character scarcity, actually encourages people to respond because they feel like, okay, 400 characters, that's easy. It won't take more than 5 minutes of my time. Whereas if I, and the site I'm referring to is a site called Ripple. If I wrote to my peers and said, hey, give me a review of how I'm doing, our instant reaction is I don't have time for this, or it's going to take a lot longer than I have. But if it's limited to 400 characters or 200 characters, then it's oh yeah, that's a trivial task. So there are those examples. I talk about curiosity and how actually playing hard to get, you know, to go back to the dating analogy, actually encourages or increases interest or participation mm-hmm. or engagement. Example there, the fundamental idea with curiosity is it's you're teasing people with specific details that entice them to want to know more.
Yeah.
And a great example, online example of that is LinkedIn, where you know, if you roll the clock back on LinkedIn, you know, at one point there was this big brick wall where they would say, you know, if you sign up and pay our monthly fee, here are all the great things you can get. Mm-hmm. So it's your traditional value prop, value pitch. And then you have all the personal stuff that you can see is what's freely available. Well, they kind of moved that wall over a bit, and they started teasing people with little details. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, someone at Apple looked at your profile this week, or, you know, a CEO in the gaming space, you know, looked at your profile this week. So they're giving you very specific details that are specific to you.
Yeah.
But if you want to know who in Apple looked at your profile or what CEO, what gaming company was looking at you, well, you have to kind of pay and, you know, to get full access to that information. So that's a great example of using curiosity. Definitely some of this is counterintuitive or seems like it would run contrary to what we know. With the gaming conversations, I think one thing a lot of people would say about gaming is, and to a certain extent, playfulness, is these are definitely less efficient methods of doing things, but the in by trading off efficiency, you actually get more engagement and more involvement. And just a simple example that I saw on a site a few weeks ago was I don't know how you describe them, but it's in the mall or in shopping centers you might go, and there's these big funnels where you can put a penny or a quarter in and watch the coin spiral down over a period of like 20 seconds or 30 seconds.
I know.
Gets faster and faster and then goes into a bucket.
Yeah.
And it's just a playful experience, but it's fun, you know, to put, watch a coin spiral around. Well, if you peel away the playfulness and the experience part, all you're doing is pulling a coin out of your pocket and throwing it in a bucket, right?
Yeah.
but if people put a bucket in the middle of the shopping center, no one would do it. So they're adding this playfulness, they're adding this inefficiency.
I think sometimes we can tend to forget that we're not kind of mindless automatons. We're not robots as human beings. And, you know, we don't always do things in the most efficient way, and we don't desire to do things in the most efficient way. And I think, you know, a lot of the time in the kind of usability background that we have and the way that we've been approaching web design for years, you know, it's all about kind of taking off the rough edges. It's all about kind of making that process as straightforward as possible. And perhaps we dehumanize it a little bit in the process.
Yep, absolutely. And I think with usability, I mean, you definitely want to remove the barriers in the UI or the interaction. Mm-hmm. But I think there's this idea that the interaction or the experience needs to be easy. And what we know from all different realms, from cognitive science to psychology, is that where it's easy, people get bored.
Yeah.
They're not engaged. In fact, what we're finding is where people really, really learn or really, you know, can devote, you know, just hours or days of their time is when you create an interesting challenge or an interesting problem, or you put out a curious question. And those are the things that, I mean, our brains actually reform in response to those. There's actually, you know, we get a little bit of a high from solving a difficult challenge. So it's something we actually just biologically crave are these challenges, nothing too difficult or else give up, but nothing too easy or else we get bored. Mm. And so I think the trick is to introduce that appropriate challenge that increases increases people's interest and engagement. In fact, there's a study with, I think it was like kindergartners it was elementary grade school. And the teacher would present the students with an interesting challenge or question. And in one test case, in another test case, the teacher would just present the knowledge, the rote facts. Mm-hmm. And in the case where it was presented as a question that the students had to figure out the answer to, a good percentage of the students, the majority of them, actually work through their recess time to solve the problem. And so I think, wow, you know, if you can look at elementary kids who are giving up recess and have time to go outside on the playground to solve this, you know, geography problem or whatever it was, I can't remember. That's powerful stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, you played this little mind game on your audience at South By as well, because you teased us, didn't you? Right at the end of the session, you gave out these mental note cards.
I did.
And you gave us a little sample of them, but I've been champing at the bit, waiting for the actual ones to be released. And so tell us a little bit about those, because I just think they're such a brilliant idea, and I really would encourage everybody to get their hands on them when you release them. So tell us, explain what they are.
Yeah, so again, I've been mentioning all these principles from psychology, and again, my background is design. I'm a designer. I don't have a degree in cognitive science or psychology, but as I started reading a lot of these you know, research papers or these business texts, and you know, some are just popular bestsellers like Predictably Irrational, things on influence like Robert Cialdini's book on influence and persuasion. As I started reading these, I started taking notes of the things they were talking about with the idea of how could I use this on my next project, my next website, or my next iPhone app? How could I use whatever the finding was from this research on this project? And I think there's a very real problem where we come across all these great ideas, but then when we get into the middle of a project, we focus on the basic usability things. We're just getting the project done on time, and we don't leave time, or we forget about all these really creative things that make our work exciting. And so out of that, I started putting each idea on a separate index card and ended up with kind of a stack of these ideas and cards. And I would pull them out, whether I was in the middle of a project or beginning a brand new project. And the idea was basically, how can we use or leverage this idea from psychology, this thing we know about human behavior, to accomplish a particular behavioral or business goal? And so the example I use is like, let's say you're trying to get more people to sign up for the homepage. Like, yeah, that's your goal. You need more people to click on that. And it could be anything. It could be get people to come back again. It could be, you know, whatever your business goals are. I translate that into a behavioral goal if it's not one already. So what do we want people to do on the site? And then the idea is you pull out one of these cards and you say, okay, how could we use curiosity to get more people to register? Or how could we use social proof to get more people to register? And the card will offer the definition of that idea and then list just some suggested application ideas to get things going. But the idea is you would draw one of these cards and you would, as a group or by yourself, you know, sit on it for a good 10, 15 minutes brainstorming different ways you could apply that principle. And a great example, I mentioned social proof early on, and I mentioned testimonials, and that's a very cliche, almost overused way to leverage social proof. But you look at something like, I think there was a campaign about 6 months ago to fix Outlook, basically. Yeah. You know, people who, you have to do emails, you know, you have to basically custom write code for Outlook. You can't just use CSS or standard markup. And so the campaign was really designed to get more people involved and promote this basically a petition against this. And they used social proof in a really clever way where when you went to the site, they had the message kind of front and center on a floating box, but the entire background was comprised of these avatars from people.
I remember seeing this.
Yeah. And the neat thing was this wallpaper of avatars. You saw like 1,000 faces staring at you. Was constantly refreshing every 10 or 15 seconds. So you'd see things. If you hovered over a face, you could actually see the tweet or see their comment. But it was a very powerful and very visual way to literally see the social proof, that see that lots of people are engaged and support behind supporting this campaign. Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, I don't know that they, you know, said how can we use social proof, or how, I don't know how they came about with the idea, but the idea of the cards is you would be able to come up with ideas like that by focusing on one principle, one thing we know about human behavior, and saying how can we use it to solve this very specific problem.
So when are these cards going to be out? When are we going to be able to get hands on them?
Yeah, so I am wrapping up the work right now, and I'm going to be shipping to the printer late next week. So it's coming along. Print time and the packaging, all that, they'll be wrapped up at the end of May, and I'll be shipping the first week in June.
Okay.
So my year and a half long journey on these cards is nearing an end, or the beginning, how you want to look at it. And I'm quite excited to get these in the hands of folks. I have been able to test pilot at some workshops that I've done, and I've just been blown away by the response.
Absolutely. We've even with that little preview set that you gave out, we've been using them, and they've been immensely useful. You can find out more about those at getmentalnotes.com, and at the moment you can pre-order them for $38. So if you're quick and get it in before they actually come out, you'll get it at a discounted price. And you get 50 in a pack, is it?
I have 52.
52, of course.
Yeah, a lot of people give me a hard time about calling it a deck and not having 52 cards. So, hey, I went ahead and threw in two extra cards.
Ah, there we go. Oh, that's good. So, for people that are impatient and want to, you know, can't be bothered to wait for the cards, they want to kind of get into this now, they're feeling all inspired by what you've been saying, are there any kind of resources that you can recommend, places that they can go to maybe read up a little bit more on psychology? I know you're intending to write a book yourself. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in this seductive interactions talk that I give, and there's a lot more ideas than 45 minutes allows to share. So I've turned that presentation that you saw at South by Southwest into an all-day workshop that I'm giving. And, of course, that workshop is helping me refine and feed into a book I'm writing that should be out in time for next year's South by Southwest.
Oh,
so, yeah.
So in the meantime, where can people go? Is there a lot of content on the web about this, or is it underrepresented?
There is a lot of content. It's just highly fragmented. And again, one of the things I found is there's all these different fields that aren't talking to each other or aren't even aware of each other.
Yeah.
Or you don't see a lot of the connections. So a lot of my work isn't going deep into one, but it's looking broad across these different fields. So cognitive science, behavioral economics, neuroscience, psychology, game design. That's what I'm trying to do with my Get Mental Notes site. So one thing I've started to do, and it's still pretty basic, but I've got a resources section on the Get Mental Notes site.
Do you know I didn't notice that? There you go.
Yeah, it's new. And I'm listing some of the general resources that I've gotten to there. And my plan with the cards is also to release those online in kind of a wiki format. Yeah. And what I'll do is for every card will get its own page. And the goal when that's released would be that people would share ways they use that principle on a project or examples in the wild that people have found. And I think that's key because, you know, you only have two or three sentences of ideas that you can put on a card. And you know, those ideas are, you know, already out of date before the cards even go to printing. So yeah. My idea is to keep – the principles are timeless, but the applications are the things that I hope to – you know, see a conversation start around. And that's been the fun part with the workshop is I put out these ideas, I could issue a creative design challenge and then I see what comes back. And I've just been blown away by the ideas that people come up with. In fact, I think there's some great startup ideas that have come out of some of these workshops. So,
brilliant. Yeah. That sounds absolutely superb.
Yep. And yeah, I'll just point people to that resources section because I've started listing books from different areas.
Yeah, I can see. I'm looking at it now.
And that'd be just a good single place to start.
Yeah. I mean, you've got two books in there that I instantly recognize, which is Made to Stick and Nudge. And there are loads of good stuff. I think those two I've mentioned on the show. I don't think I've mentioned any of the others. So it's great to check out. GetMentalNotes.com/resources. Thank you so much, Stephen. That was absolutely brilliant. Really good to have you on the show. And it's an area that I'm absolutely fascinated by. And I can see myself spending a fortune on all the books in your resources section.
I spend a fortune on them myself.
I'll make sure that I keep some back for your book when it comes out as well. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And I would very much like to get you back at some point in the future as well.
That would be fantastic. Well, thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Right, and so we come to the last section of our show today, which is a review, really, by me of the iPad.
It's lovely and shiny.
It's lovely and shiny. No.
That'll do, won't it?
I've kind of got past the honeymoon period with it, and it's now just a kind of normal
device.
It's
now just a big, big iPhone with no telephone. It is, though.
Yes, but that isn't a bad thing. That's a good thing.
You should be able to make phone calls on it just by talking to it. It'd be great.
Well, I'm sure. We could do with Skype.
Yeah, you could with Skype.
There you go.
Has it got a mic?
Yeah.
All right.
So you could. There you go. Can do. What more do you want? Anyway,
I don't know whether I want one or not. Well, sell it to me, Paul.
Well, I'm not going to sell it to you because I've really tried to do an unbiased, non-Apple-y response to this. And I wanted to kind of narrow the field instead of just looking at it generally. I want to ask, is there a business case for buying an iPad, right?
For me.
For anybody, right? Rather than the, you know, is there... you know, is it nice to have, do I want it, that kind of thing, where, you know, yes, it's sexy, yes, it's cool, but is it actually a useful business tool?
Well, yes, that's the question that I need answering.
Yes, so that's what we're going to cover. But first of all, I do want to say that this review is brought to you by Shopify, which is an e-commerce solution made by designers for designers. And for more information, visit shopify.com/BoagWorld. And I would ask that you do visit them. Just check out what they're doing, because they've been a massive supporter for the show for so long.
And we love Shopify.
Yeah, we really appreciate their involvement. Okay, so the review. As a web designer, and to a lesser extent, website owners, we love our web gadgets, don't we? The iPad is no exception. However, if we look at it dispassionately from an entirely business perspective, is it worth the money? So I think it's really important that we're honest from the start. The iPad is not designed primarily as a work machine. It's designed for watching videos, reading books, and surfing the web while lounging around our house. That's what it's designed for, all right? That said, I think there are three possible, and I do say possible, business reasons for getting an iPad. Testing, the applications it provides, and portability. So I'm going to examine each of these.
Right.
So, you know, when you're desperately trying to come up with a reason to buy yourself an iPad, testing is probably your first line of attack. Oh, I need to test websites on the iPad. After all, the iPad is selling like hotcakes, which means it's not going to be long before a lot of people will be accessing your site using it. It's also true that the iPad is a unique browsing experience, especially in terms of its touchscreen. There are also differences between how the iPad and the iPhone renders a web page. So it's not enough just to check on the iPhone. And none of the iPad browser simulators that I've tried accurately display it in the same way as the real thing does. So I have to say, testing is a fairly solid argument for having at least one iPad within your company. However, let's not kid ourselves. We're not anywhere near as keen to spend hundreds of dollars buying a screen reader piece of software to check to see if our websites are accessible for those people. So it's probably an excuse, mm-hmm. but it may be as a fairly valid excuse. Okay? So,
well, we've already got two within the company.
Yeah. So you, from your point of view, okay.
And I don't do testing anyway.
No, exactly. So next one is for the applications. The iPad has some great applications for web designers and website owners. And so I thought I'd pick out a few of the ones that are most notable from my point of view and worth noting.
Okay.
Notable from my point of view, worth noting, yes. Lots of notings there. The first one is TweetDeck, which is the ultimate way to stay on top of your social media responsibilities. Right.
I can't believe you just said that.
I think for a lot of people listening to this, one of the big things that I was talking about a lot of future web design is the importance of personal brand and the idea of if you're a freelancer, it's particularly important that you build up your reputation and people know you. And I think it's also important, even personally, for your career these days, that things like Twitter are an important part of what we do. And we do need to take them seriously rather than just being a novelty. So TweetDeck, good application, useful to have. But of course, you got that on the desktop as well.
Yeah.
Rackspace and Instapaper. In my opinion, the iPad is how RSS was meant to be read. All right?
Okay.
It's so much nicer being able to relax on the couch rather than sit at your desk, although admittedly you could do that with a laptop. Mm. But those two applications, Instapaper and NewsRack, are two brilliant applications for reading. And I think there is something really valuable from being able to go away from your computer, go elsewhere, and be able to keep up to date with, you know, what you're learning. And I think kind of from a state of mind and a physical point of view, I think it's good for you not to be spending so much time sitting at your desk reading this kind of stuff. So being able to go outside, sit in the sun, read your RSS feeds, brilliant. And the iPad is pretty good for that. And I would recommend it. The other application that I think is really good on the iPad is Dropbox. And that because it's given you instant access to all your files, which already for me has been a lifesaver. At Future Web Design, where this guy dropped out and someone needed to kind of do a fill-in, I could literally stand on the stage with my iPad and dip into different presentations that I had all straight from the iPad, which, you know, was quite a unique thing. I think your chances are you're going to have your iPad with you a lot more than you would have a laptop. And I think it's very useful because it's so lightweight. But we'll come on to that in a minute. FTP on the go is another great web designer application, which allows you to connect to web servers and make and edit files to your heart's content. I wouldn't want to do a lot of coding on this, but it's great for quick changes when you discover you've done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really good. There's also, and this is a good one, you might like this one, something called Audio Notes for the iPad, right? Okay. I have to say, I think this is possibly the best note-taking application ever, right? So you go into a meeting, mm-hmm. you hit a record button, okay? And then you carry on with your meeting and you make notes as normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the meeting, you walk out. Now, you look at your notes and go, okay, I've got this action point to do, or that somebody said this, but I can't really remember what they were getting at, or, you know, or I'm sure there's another bit of information there, or what date did they say that was? I didn't write it down. You can click on your note and it'll play back the audio for that exact moment when you wrote the note.
That's good.
That is cool.
Mm.
So I like that a lot. So
how much does it cost?
About £2.
It's great, isn't it?
I know. Absolutely awesome. So next one.
Awesome.
Is a really good one, is mood boards for the iPad. I mean, we use mood boards a lot in our design process, and they're a great way to give the client a feel for our approach without spending too much time on design. However, creating mood boards can be fairly time-consuming in their own right, especially if you get carried away. So mood boards for the iPad makes the whole process so quick and painless, and it would be perfectly possible to throw together a mood board with the client in a matter of minutes. And having that interaction, and you couldn't do this on a laptop, not the way that it's done here. It can only be done with a touch device like this, where you can just grab things, move them around, and it's just brilliant. So I'd highly recommend it for that.
We need a table-sized one, really, don't we?
Yeah,
you
do.
The iTable.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, that's what the Surface is, Microsoft Surface. Then the final one I wanted to mention is something called iMockup. Although nowhere near as sophisticated as something like Flare Builder, iMockup does allow you to create quick and dirty wireframes with the client. I have to say, mine personally, I think I prefer pen and paper, but it is an alternative that is available on the iPad.
Have you got pages on it?
Yeah, you've got pages, you've got numbers, you've got Keynote, all of that kind of stuff as well.
Okay.
All right.
Pages would be good.
Yeah, and it's not bad. It's pretty good. Yeah. Obviously, the list of applications is only going to grow over time. However, although these applications will only become more impressive, I don't think the iPad will ever be what you call a powerful production workhorse kind of thing. It is primarily meant as a consumption device for consuming information rather than production. At a push, you can do both, but I think you'll find yourself returning to your laptop for most production work.
What would be useful for me is if I was going to a meeting, or I was going away for a couple of days,
yeah,
or that kind of thing, and something came up.
Yeah,
I had to complete something,
yeah,
or whatever. I could use that to do it. Then it would be useful.
Yes, that's what it will do. It will do that, but you're not going to... Let's say you had to finish a proposal, for example, or make some changes to a proposal. You could do it. It would be fine, but there would be a little bit of you that would wish you had your laptop with you.
Right.
But it's kind of worth it for the portability of which is the last point I want to come on to. You know, and in some ways, I think, is a big business reason if, like you and me, we're traveling around a lot and doing quite a lot. This really is, for example, the perfect conference device. And it's also ideal for client meetings.
I was going to say, would, at South by Southwest, would you take your laptop?
No.
Okay.
I say that with a reservation. The reservation being, I have not yet tried Keynote connected to an external monitor or a projector because I haven't got the dongle yet.
Right.
But presuming it works as it appears to work, then I think I would just go with the iPad. It will limit me slightly because Keynote, because you can only use the fonts that are available on the iPad. You can't install fonts.
Right.
Which is a disadvantage.
Why can't you install
fonts? I know, because Apple are Apple and they do things the way they do things. That might change, but at the moment, that's the way it is. I think this is ideal for client meetings. I think it's ideal for conferences. Lugging a laptop around just for the sake of taking a few notes, checking emails, surfing the web seems overkill. Mm. That said, I think there are two flaws in the argument. First, if you already own a laptop, you know, I don't know whether you can justify the additional expense just for a few pounds in weight, right? Mm. Second, if you want portability, then really you need 3G connectivity.
Yep.
Of course, the 3G connectivity is more expensive. You have to get a more expensive version of the iPad. And it only provides 3G for the iPad, right? So it's a monthly expense that you're paying out to be able to connect the iPad to 3G.
Mm.
You know, what if you then decide to take your laptop?
Yeah.
Now, It's not like Mr. Jobs in his all-surpassing generousness has allowed us to tether our laptops to our iPads. No. He allowed us to tether our iPhones to our iPad, our laptops? Yes, but again, it's an expense and you've got all these different expenses. Mm. Even if you could tether your laptop to your iPad, it's quite a big modem to carry around, isn't it, effectively. So, there is one option to this, one solution, which is what I've done, which is I've got something called a MiFi. Have you ever seen these?
I haven't, no. I've heard of that.
Look, you can see a little picture of one there, right?
Okay.
All right, so it's basically a little silver box, you know, smaller than the iPhone.
Oh, right, and it's like a 3G device that creates a Wi-Fi network?
Yes.
Okay.
So Ooh. Then you can connect your Wi-Fi iPhone to it, or your laptop. Which right. is the perfect kind of workaround, in my
so
opinion.
So then you only need to buy a Wi-Fi
Yes.
iPad. Right.
So is there a business case? If I'm completely honest, I would say in most cases the answer is no. The testing argument is strong, but it's still early days, and although it's nice to know that your sites work on your on the iPad, it's probably not critical. Unless you're a constant road warrior, as they say, you know, who does nothing but surf the web, answer emails and take notes, then I don't think the iPad is business critical. It's nice to have, but you will find yourself constantly returning to the laptop. However, buy one anyway. there may not be a business case, but you won't regret it for a minute. It's a great media consumption device, and it will prevent you from spending so many hours hunched over your laptop in a darkened room. Sometimes I think you've just got to treat yourself. And I think that's what the iPad is, and you should recognize it and you should go for it.
Maybe. I mean, if the perfect world, I would get an iMac
right.
for my office and one of those for my going aboutness.
Yes.
But I've got two offices.
Yeah.
So I can't. I have to have a laptop. And I just think that a 15-inch laptop, maybe even get a 13-inch laptop, it's so... You know, the difference is so minimal.
Yeah.
And obviously the laptop but is I'm so saying, much more powerful.
But I'm saying you shouldn't get this because of work. Yeah. I'm saying you should
just get one anyway.
You should get one for you.
Yeah.
Because at home, it's just... I mean, the amount of time...
What if the dog chewed it?
Well...
he wouldn't chew it, he'd lick it.
Well, that's all right. Licking's fine. You know, but the amount of time you spend sitting in front of your laptop reading BBC News or...
Yeah, that's true.
You know, or watching a YouTube video someone sent or checking Twitter, you know,
or
all
email.
Of those things. Yeah, or email. You know, to be able to be free from a laptop... You know, I think is great. Now, people have all kinds of issues over it. Like, you know, is it comfortable to type on? I find it in horizontal, I can type just as fast as I can type normally. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're sitting at, you know, sitting at a table and you've got it down flat in front of you, although even on your lap, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people complain that it gets uncomfortable to hold after a long length of time. I personally haven't found that. You know, I've watched entire movies holding it. I sit a lot of the time in a chair with my legs crossed and kind of it between my legs.
Mm.
And that's very comfortable. So I found it really, really good. I watch a lot of films on this. And actually I find it as good an experience watching films as watching on the big TV because you're holding it quite close and because the resolution's quite high.
Mm.
It's actually a really good movie, watching experience. It's great for reading books. It's great for reading RSS feeds and that kind of stuff. It's great for watching video podcasts, but none of those, well, except the RSS, none of those are really business reasons to have it.
No, I'm not convinced. Maybe.
No, and that's fair enough. I mean, yeah. I've tried to be really dispassionate over it. You know, I love it for me, but I'm not convinced it's the best business tool in the world. No. And it was never meant to be, so it's not surprising.
No.
So all those people in Headscape that are saying, can I have one for business reasons? I've now put forward a logical reason why not. There we go.
Yes, I'm going to become the company's chief tester as of today.
Ryan has said this to me. He said, if you don't buy me an iPad, I will constantly ask you to test things.
Which is fair enough, really.
You got a joke for us, Marcus?
I have. This is from Jim BT. Thank you very much. Not my favourite, but it did make me snigger a little bit. What do you get when you...
So hang on a minute. So you thank this guy, you say his name out, and then say it's not a very good joke.
It's all right. You might really like it.
Okay.
You know, the kind of jokes I like are usually the crappiest of all.
That is
so
true.
It's actually quite a good
joke. That is true. It could be a brilliant joke as a result.
Here we go.
Yeah.
It isn't. what do you get when you throw a piano down a mineshaft?
No, I can't get it.
A flat minor.
That is bad. you know, I keep hearing jokes recently. I say, I must remember that to use it on the show, and I never do. There's some really funny ones going around Twitter. Oh my God, I can't remember any of them now.
A neutron walks into a bar. How much for a drink, he asks. Bartender replies, for you, no charge.
Oh, dear me. That's a really geeky joke.
Yes. So scientist-y joke.
A scientist-y joke. Thank you very much for listening to this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed the interview with Stephen Anderson, which I thought was brilliant. Very, very clever guy. And we won't see you next week. So in the meantime, what you have to do is go to facebook.com/BoAgward and sign on up. And we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
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 The podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis.
Bye.